also sitting at home, just not doing anything. I'm going to give it to my mom, I think.
Yeah.
She has an old iBook, old iBook, like the first generation iBook, and like it's running OS 9, and it's like, oh, I can't browse web pages. So I think I'm going to get a pair. I'd like to send it to her, but she would have no idea how to use OS 10. It'd be like ridiculous. So I have to go and then give her an on-site workshop.
Are you going home today?
No. Are you doing anything?
I'm going home.
Lucky. Okay. Where's home?
Sure.
That's not too far.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
So, you know, a couple hours away. And I got a really cheap plane. So.
Cool.
Okay, well, let's get started. So, give me that time, just take home exam. So, how's that going? Really? It's like too long?
Well, the thing is that some of it was like really trivial and took like 30 seconds.
Okay.
And then some of it, I've been looking at it for hours and it looks like it should be very, very simple, but it is not.
Okay.
Which is intensely frustrating, as you can imagine.
Right, any other feedback or comments? Okay. Well, okay, well, next, you know, next we'll be, after the spring break, we'll be back to problem sets, which are... well, rather designed to test you, they're designed to show you things that we think are really cool, and let you work through things that are fun. And then, which brings me to the next thing, which is the following. So, okay, next week is spring break, and then the week after that, on Thursday, your project proposals are due. And so this is an opportunity to not just work on what we think is fun, but to work on what you think is fun. So I hope you take advantage of it. I hope you do some project that really excites you, really grabs you. So please feel free to talk to me or Shashu if you want some, you know, preliminary feedback before you turn in the proposal. You're not, of course, graded on this proposal. It's just an opportunity for feedback to let us tell you if we think that's a reasonable project to do. And people who are auditing, you're also welcome to do a project, and we'll read it and give you feedback on it. How's the project thinking going? Do people have something that they are excited about and want to do, or are people kind of hunting around the project still?
I don't know. I don't want to be the first one to offer, but I wanted to do something in terms of like taking gray pictures and working them into a color, like color visualization.
Oh.
Is that a project, or is that something like
sure,
not really involved with this?
No, that's fine. That involves a lot of tools. I can. Last year's SIGGRAPH, there was a paper on that topic. And, I mean, it's not to say.
I want to participate. I just want to, you know, it's just.
Yeah, sure. Let's see. So, of the people who are taken for credit and have to come up with the project, how many people have a pretty good idea of what they're aiming for? And how many people don't have a good idea of what they're aiming for? Okay. So, people in the latter category, feel free to, you know, chat about what would be good. I could sort of hand you ideas, that's one approach, or you can talk about what would excite you and we can try to work it into a project. And then regarding the exam, as you mentioned, Shashu was kindly offered to stay here till midnight tonight. But yes, you should. So there's certain security things that kick in after 5 to stay there. So be sure not to. Is it paper or electronic submission?
Either one.
Yeah.
Okay. There's security. Yeah.
But maybe they could call you on the phone or send you an email and you can arrange. So.
Okay. Yeah. I don't have my phone number right here.
Okay.
Off the class.
Okay.
Just call me. Not anything for you.
Okay. And of course, you don't have to wait till the next time.
Okay.
So, we're talking about probabilistic models, generative models. So last class we looked at different ways to fit problems to data to models of it. We talked about EM. And then we're in the middle of looking at these modularized joint probability distributions described by so-called graphical models. And so these are just some slides. So the reading is this paper, which I really like, by Jordan and Weiss. Covers much of what I'll be talking about. And also I wanted to point you out to Kevin Murphy's webpage, which is comprehensive and more advanced, a little bit less tutorial, but it also has tutorial parts to it. We went through a toy example where we had five different variables, and you can have a general function that takes you from the values of those five variables to some number between 0 and 1, and if it's normalized, right, it'll be a probability distribution. And typically what you want to do is, like, some of these variables might be things that you observe, some of them might be variables that you don't care about. Typically you want to take this big joint distribution and narrow it down to just the one that really matters to you, and that would involve typically marginalizing over the other variables, or else taking the maximum over the other variables, whether you're interested in MMSE or in MAP estimation. And in general, that's going to be a hard problem because this is really high dimensional. It's taking an integral over this very high dimensional space. This is a toy version of a high dimensional problem. The real high dimensional ones are very, very high dimensional. But if you assume some modularity to this distribution, then you can really make a lot of progress. And so we talked about these graphical models that describe, well, if they have arrows, they describe both the modularity and what causes what. So you can take your general distribution and just use this sort of chain rule to rewrite it in this form. Now this is still true for every, you know, for any general distribution of those five variables. But then at this point, we can make it the modularity assumption and simplify it greatly. So if we assume that this distribution isn't the most general one, but falls into the special class where it has this set of dependence relationships, then you can rewrite this last line as this one. And so, for example, this term, which is probability of x5 given x1, x2, x3, x4, well, if this represents the conditional independence structure, anything that's x probability of x5 given x4, once you know x4, you don't care what those other values are because x4 sort of encompasses everything that those are going to tell you already. So the probability of x5 given x1, x2, x3, x4 is just the same as probability of x5 given x4. And similarly, this one, we can simplify it to being probability of x4 given x3. And we don't care what the values of x1 and x2 are because once we know x3, we know everything there is to know as far as x4 is concerned. So that takes you from this general, very hard to integrate distribution to this one, which is just like Lego blocks, you know, it's just modular completely. And now the marginalization that we want to do just passes through all the Lego blocks and the sums land on the blocks that they're supposed to operate on. So what had been this, if we want to look at the marginal distribution on x1, which again, is like the thing you care about, you know, where is the hand, given all the data I see. Then you want to integrate over all the other variables. And this toy problem is it's a sum over four variables. Now they distribute and land in these very sort of modular pieces. And now instead of having to do this as this huge volumetric sum, you can just do it in these partial sums and pass them along. And you get the exact same answer, but you get it much, much faster. So we went through that example where if these guys have 10 state dimensions each, to do this sum in the general case takes 10 to the 4 operations, and to do it in this case takes 4 times 10 operations. So it's a huge gain. And it's splitting out like this, that's called, it's called many things. It's called the Collin filter, and if you look at it the right way, it's also called leaf propagation. Um, And then there's kind of two flavors of these graphical models. One is the ones that have arrows, where you talk about sort of causality. And these are often used for AI problems or for temporal inference problems, because they're one time sort of causing the next time. For two-dimensional layout problems, for vision problems, typically you don't know what causes what, and you just know that they're related, and you might know the conditional independence relationships, that if you know this one, then you don't care about these other guys as far as this one's concerned. So then you draw the graphical model without arrows, as an undirected graph, and then you would call it a Markov chain or a Markov random field. And the word Markov is what describes that assumption that if you, for example, fix X3, then that tells you everything you need to know as far as X4 is concerned, and you don't need to know X1 and X2. And for the general, for a Markov random field, or Markov chain, joint probability has this modular form. So it's really very similar to the one we had before with the arrows. You have these functions that are little local functions that are functions of neighboring nodes. This is a function of x1, x2, this function of x2, x3, x3, and x4. But instead of calling them conditional probabilities, now they're just general compatibility matrices. They're compatibility functions. And we also call them cleat potentials. And so this is the general form, and you might write it as the normalization factor 1 over z, so that the whole thing integrates out to 1 when you integrate over all the variables. But you can do the same tricks with this one. If you want to marginalize over all the variables except this one, then you sum over each one of them, but the sum gets to pass through all the compatibility functions that it doesn't operate on, and you get a modularized set, as in the other case, and I'll show you that. So. And then we went on to a particular case of that Markov network, which is a two-dimensional Markov random field. And so typically these nodes are the kind of things you want to estimate about the image, and these are the things you observe. When you have it in that form of a sort of two-dimensional layout, typically this is for low-level vision problems, like finding the height everywhere, or finding the reflectance values. If you wanted to estimate whether this was a horse or a dog, you might not have just a two-dimensional flat grid. You might have some different structure than that. Certainly, it would be at the very least hierarchical. So we looked a little bit about how you solve these things. Here, I think. Yeah, so here's, for this two-dimensional case, here's the form for the joint probability. So the balloons that were floating up above, those are the image observations. They could be pixel values you observe, or they could be patches of the image. And then the things underneath that are connected to each other, those might be the scene variables. And again, they could be pixel values, like for the surface height, or they could be patches describing local regions. But again, this thing has this similar form of cleat potentials or compatibility functions between nodes that are connected with the line, and also the observed and the unobserved ones. And the Hammersley-Clifford theorem tells you that you can write any Markov random field distribution in this form. So now we've figured out what we want to optimize. And again, the advantage of going to this form is that all you have to figure out is just how this guy relates to this guy. You know, it's nice, modular, localized. What you get out of it are these kind of global properties, because they all talk to each other and they let you propagate things globally, but you don't have to think globally, you just have to think locally. So then there are lots of, so then the game is, given certain image, what states that you're trying to estimate maximize this probability, or maybe what's the mean of the probability given the observation? And in general, this is a NP-hard problem to solve if these are discrete states. So there are a lot of approximation methods that have been built up over the years, and we went over a couple last time, Gibbs sampling, right. iterated conditional modes, and we stopped here at variational methods. So we're going to go on, just briefly talking about variational methods, talk about leaf propagation, talking about free energy methods, and then go into vision applications of this. So that's a review of where we are. Are there questions or comments that people want to make? So, actually, a little bit out of order. I'm going to talk about leaf propagation and then also talk about variational methods. But just on the subject of variational methods, Tommy Arpa has a nice tutorial on the web about them. And one example of a variational method is mean field, and we'll give an example of that in
a little bit in this lecture. So let's kind of introduce leaf propagation and variational methods together.
So this is just going to show you the same thing that we looked at with the directed line. Suppose we have this toy example. These are observations. These are what we're trying to estimate. These have these local compatibility functions. We want to find the mean value of this guy. We want to add up. These are observations, so they're fixed. And then these are the unknown variables that we don't care about, so we're going to marginalize over those. So we sum over all values of this one weighted by its probability. Same with this one. Sum the joint probability over all values of this, over all the values of this one to get the marginal probability down. And written in the general form, there's not much you can do. But again, because we have this modular form, these sums are going to pass through the these local leaf potentials, like the sum over x3. This is going to factor through this function of x1 and x2, and of x2 and y2, and of x1 and x2, and finally we'll land here. So again, we have these sets of partial sums.
Is the leaf potential something we know, or?
Right, so that's a good point. There's two pieces to solving the MRF. One, you have to define the MRF, and then you have to solve it. Right now, I'm talking about how to solve it, and then later we'll talk about how you set it up.
Okay.
And sometimes it's given to you what it is, sometimes you have to learn those values from observations. So, assume we have them, then this is the marginalization. And so here's the sum that we had in the previous one. And what we're going to notice is that this sum over the values of x3, we're going to call that, sort of shorthand, call it a message from node 3 to node 2. And what is that message? Well, it takes in, this is compatibility between these two nodes, and it's a function of x2 because we know what. Sorry, I got it wrong. This is the one I meant. So this is the local evidence. It's a leaf potential or compatibility function between this thing you don't know and this thing you observe. And because you observe this state, it's just a vector as a function of x3. So there's a vector coming in here, and then this term is a matrix. It has two sets of states, two indices, the states of x3 indexed here and states of x2 indexed here. So you can think of that as the rows and the columns. And we multiply this by this vector of the states of x2 and sum over, we multiply this vector by the states of x3 and sum over the states of x3 to get a vector as a function of the states of x2, right? I should draw it out on the board. So compatibility, phi, between x3 and y3. So this is observed. So I know its value. So this term is just a vector in the states of x3. And then we have this term here, And this compatibility term is psi, a function of the states of x2 and x3. And this is a matrix where the states of x2 are like this, states of x3 are like this. And each entry is that value of that function. So we're going to take this vector.
The size of the joint probability of the state of x2 and
x3? It's related to it. There's certain normalization factors that make it not exactly the joint probability. For these being directed graphs, it might be the conditional probability of this one given that one. I drew them back, but this is the x3 dimension, this is the x2 dimension. And what this partial sum here, which this one is telling you to do, is to say take this vector which has the dimensions of the states of x3, multiply it by this matrix which has the dimensions of states of x3, states of x2, and sum over the states of x3. Well, that's multiplying the vector times matrix. And that gives you this message from node 3 to node 2, which is this function of the states of x2. And so that's one little operation of the leaf propagation. Yes?
So I have a quick question. Maybe I'm just missing something. But if we're looking for the Bayes' square estimator.
Okay.
Why are we looking at conditional probability? Or am I just stupid?
I mean, why are we...
So why are we looking at x1 given y's?
Right, so we're playing with this thing, p of x and y, and we're summing over all the variables to get p of x1 and y. And you're saying what we really want is P of x1 given all the y's. Right. But we know that this joint probability is just equal to the thing which is precisely what we want times the probability that we would get x, the observation we saw. But you can think of this just as a normalization factor. We have this observation.
But it affects the expected value, though. As if we were taking the mode, then maybe.
Right, you take the mode, and then you just have to make sure. Finally, you'll get this distribution, and when you take the expected value, we'll just have to normalize it properly. I mean, we'll have to remember. You're right; it will affect the expected value, but we'll have to remember to take the sum over x1 of x1. P of x1 and y, and divide by sum over x1, P of x1 y. Yes. That's a good point. Let's see. So this gives us what we're going to call the message from node 3 to node 2. And again, where did it come from? It just came from this marginalization. And the fact that we have this modular form for the probability distribution. So now we do it again. We say that this thing, this whole thing here, is going to be a message from node 2 to node 1. And what's the procedure for getting that message? Well, the general procedure is going to be that we look at all the messages coming into x2, and they're going to be a function of the states of x2. And we multiply them all together. So here's one message going into x2. That's a function of x2. Here's another one going into x2 because this is observed. So this just depends on the states of x2. So here's one message. Here's another message. We multiply them together. And then here, this is a matrix that takes you from the states of x2 to the states of x1. And so we dot star all these vector messages together, and then multiply by this matrix here, and sum over the states of x2. So, so in that case, we have x1, So we have this message, which is since y2 is observed, which just depends on the space of x2. We have this message that we worked out before. We have this other message, which is m from node 3 to node 2, is equal to x2. And then we have, so this is a vector, and this is a vector. And then we have this thing here, which is psi indexed by these two sets of states. And that's, looks like this. So again, the thing tells us to multiply term by term this matrix, this vector by this vector, and then take that and multiply it by this matrix, summing over the dimension of x2. Well, that's just a vector times a matrix. And that gives us another term that's a function of the space of x1, and we'll call that the message from node 2 to node 1. So then finally, when we're done with this, we say that the x1 so the key of x1, if we ignore the normalization factor, we call k, is just k times the message from node 2 to node 1, function of x1, and then the message from sort of the message from the local observation to the state, which was psi of x1 comma y1, and that's it. So this is just a function of x1, and that's our final output. And then if you want to take the mean, you can use this expression. So this, I hope, shows the connection between doing the marginalization and passing these messages. So Brendan Frey calls belief propagation the nosy neighbor rule, where each node is like a neighbor, and they say, well, look, given everything that I know about my state, here's what I think that you should think about your state. So, in other words, X2 sitting there talking to X1, saying, well, look, all these people have talked to me, and they tell me these certain things, and then I know how you and I relate. So I know what I think I'm supposed to be, and I know how you and I are supposed to relate to each other, so therefore you should be like this. And you send a message as a function of these guys' states saying what weight that this one should put on its states based on what you think you know about yourself. And so the general rule for passing messages, okay, so a message is a set of weights on every one of your possible states. In general, you're in some general configuration of relationships with your neighbors. Let's say you have four neighbors. Here's the rule for sending a message. You multiply together all your incoming messages, which are a function of your state, except from the node that you're talking to. Multiply all those together, term by term, and then multiply matrix, vector times matrix, multiply that by this matrix that relates your state to your neighbor's states. And that gives you a vector in terms of your neighbor's states that says what you think that neighbor should be thinking about itself. So that's the message passing. And then when you're done with the message passing, there's a rule for how you decide what your marginal probability is, and that is you look at all the messages that are coming into you, and you multiply them together term by term. So there are all these functions of the states of xj, they get multiplied together term by term, and you get a thing called the belief at xj, which is the approximation for what the marginal probability is there. Now, if the network is a tree or a chain, it's exactly what the marginal probability is there. Because these partial sums, everything works out great. And if it's not a tree or a chain, then it's just an approximation. So this is the same set of rules. So when the network forms a tree or a chain, it's the standard do the right thing Bayesian algorithm. You know, we're just marginalizing properly. When the variables are Gaussians, over time, this is exactly a Kalman filter. And then for hidden Markov models, this it's the forward-backward algorithm, and when you're doing MAP estimation, it's the Turby algorithm. And so let's see what happens when there are loops. So here's the simplest possible network with a loop. And let's try to do the same thing. So we're going to write it in this modular form. The joint probability of all these variables is the local potentials, so how much this observation influences the underlying state at x3, so that's this one, psi x3, y3, and then same for x2, y2, that's here, and same for x1, y1, that's here. And then we have these statistical relationships between the x's, so there's x2, y2, x2, x3, x1, x3, x1, x2. So we want to look at node x1, and we want to sum over x2 and x3s. But here's the bug, the factorization doesn't work anymore. So we want to sum over x3, but now all these terms have x3s in them, and you can't get rid of them. So if you sum over x3, then you get an x2 and you get an x1. But so instead of having a vector message that's passed as a result of this, you have a matrix message because they're all connected with each other. So it doesn't work with loops. You have to, they described in the Jordan and Weiss paper what to do. You have to increase the state dimensionality. You have to say, well, I think these guys together form one node of all the states of X2 cross all the states of X3. And then the thing would form a chain again, and then you're okay. But the price you pay for that is increasing the state dimension. So you have, instead of having 10 states, you have 10 times 10 states.
Isn't that terrible for image?
Yeah, right. Yes, exactly. It's terrible for image. You can't do that approach for images. But here's what's really cool. The belief propagation rules, they're just a set of rules, and they're exact for a tree. But you can just sit there at your local node and pretend you're a tree and just do those rules on the messages coming into you and send out messages going out. And you would get an answer. You could do it until you converge. And what's cute is that if you do that, just ignore the fact that you're not a tree or a chain and apply those rules, which are optimal in that case, apply them in the general case, and you get great results for some certain cases. So error-correcting codes, you get the best error-correcting codes in the world if you do that operation. Do an algorithm that's equivalent to running belief propagation in a network with loops. So the way that images are transmitted from Jupiter is by running belief propagation and ignoring the fact that you're in loops. You have loops. So that's cool. And then we've played with the provision applications, and we sit there in this densely interconnected grid, and we just pass the messages back and forth as if we were locally in a tree or a chain. and we also get very good results. So this is encouraging, but it also brings up questions like, what's going on? Why does it work? What are you computing when you do that procedure? And so this is part of my job talk at MIT, so there's my name all over the place here. But, I spent some time, and other people did too, trying to figure out why this works so well, what's going on. And so in collaboration with Yair Weiss, we show that if these things are Gaussians and you do that operation, the means you get are guaranteed to be the right ones. Now the covariances are going to be wrong, but the means are correct. And it's kind of cute how the covariances are wrong. The assumption that you make when you do this, even though you're in a loopy network, you assume that all these messages coming into you are independent of each other. But really, they've come from, you know, all these little paths. And so you're taking these things which came from rumors, and you're treating them like each one is an independent observation. And so you end up being much more confident about your estimate than you should be. It's like you hear a stock tip three different times, and it really is from the same person, essentially. But you think that it's three different independent observations, and you go, wow, this stock is really great, you know. But you're fooling yourself. But so with Gaussian processes, you'll get the right guess for which is the best stock, as it were, or what's the best state to estimate, but you'll be overconfident in your covariance estimates. Again, we always have these two flavors that we have, the MAP and the MMSE flavor. So the MMSE flavor is when you marginalize, and the MAP flavor is when you take the maximum. So you can do that same modular operation as we talked about before, and instead of taking sums, you take the maximum in order to find the MAP estimate. So it turns out that if you do that procedure, that the you get a very large, you get a local maximum, but it's a maximum over a very large local neighborhood. So that also works quite well. And then, in collaboration with a physicist at my old lab, and Yair Weiss, we showed that running belief propagation until it converges is equivalent to using the Bethe approximation to solve to free energy. And this is a well-known and well-understood approximation in statistical physics. So that was a nice connection to something where we know what's going on. And then Martin Rainwright and Alan Liskey and Tony Apla have gone further, a lot of people have gone further actually, and developed other approaches and even new algorithms, in part based on some of this work and also based on other things as well. So there's a lot, so in particular Wainwright's developed new algorithms. We're actually we're somewhat better than belief propagation for solving these loopy networks. But for this class, we'll just focus on belief propagation. Okay, so not to be painful, but just to be sort of complete, I have to take you through a little bit of the statistical mechanics and computation of this. So here's something that physicists like to do. They like to calculate a quantity called the free energy, and in a second we'll relate it back to the joint probability that we're trying to compute. But if you have a physical system, and the x1, x2, x3 are now states in a physical system, for example, might be spin states of a ferromagnetic material, and you have an energy associated with each collection of states and a probability associated with each one. You can compute the average energy, which is the weighted average of the energies, and you can compute the entropy, which is p log p for summing over, if you sum over all the states, it's the expected value of the log probability. And you can introduce a temperature parameter. And it turns out that this quantity, the average energy minus T times the entropy, is called the free energy, and it's a very useful quantity to compute. Now let's relate it to the problem we have at hand. So let's, we have these compatibility, these clique potentials or these compatibility matrices between our neighboring states in the probability system. And let's define that to be e to the minus energy of those two states divided by temperature parameter. Let's define the local potential at a single node to e to the minus energy of that node divided by temperature. And if you make those definitions, then it turns out that the probability distribution for the Markovnikov field, when you compute its free energy, if the joint probability that minimizes the free energy is exactly the joint probability that is defined by the Markov network here. So what do we get from this connection with physicists? Well, we have two ways now of finding the optimal set of states. We're finding, for example, the maximum probability configuration. We can plug into our formula for a Markov random field and keep changing the values of each state until we maximize the probability. That's one way. Or another way is we can convert into this physics terminology and define free energy and find the probability distribution that minimizes the free energy. So it's two ways that will give you the exact same set of states. Yes?
I like to be trying to figure out on the compatibility relations between all these E's. But like E of Xi alone is E of Xi, Xj, summed over all Xj, or half of them. So what are you actually solving for a bunch of distinct functions E?
These are distinct functions E.
And what are they?
Pardon?
And what are E?
Well, the E's correspond to the energy.
Yeah, but what do you mean by energy? What? Is that something we find?
Let's see. Well, in the physics terminology, it corresponds to the energy of that particular state. But here, we're just treating it as a function that relates to these compatibilities, which are the...
Oh, so we define a compatibility, and therefore...
Yeah.
E. Okay.
Right. So for example, if you're talking about two magnetic fields that are neighboring to each other, if they're in the same direction, they'll be energetically favorable, and then if they flip, they'll be less happy. And then in addition, you might have an external field on these, which would affect this term, that each one of them by itself would want to be aligned with the external magnetic field. And then that's in the physics view. And then in the probability view, you might have two states, two disparities that you're trying to estimate, and if they're neighbors, they won't have the same value, and they get penalized if they have different values, so that would affect this thing. And then, in addition, you might have some local evidence just for each one by itself as to how much it matches up with the left eye image for a stereo problem, and that would influence this local potential.
Maybe I think there's another question, which is in the previous slide, in setting up the energetic formulation, you have a single function E which is over all the variables, and I'm asking how that function E relates to all these little functions E that are separate from the imagination.
Right.
Given the way that you wrote that, given that you're more fundamental exponentials, is this E then just the sum of all those E's on the next slide?
Yeah, that's a good point. Right, we're going to see. Actually, it is, and then we're going to... yes, so we're going to have to subtract for the times when we double count. So if you have an E as a function of x1 and x2, and an E in a function of x2 and x3, and if you add them together, then you'll have to subtract that one time the E of x2 just by itself. Yeah, that's a good point. I should make that clearer on the slides. So we have these two ways of finding the best states, finding the find the probabilities function of these variables. We can either find the distribution that minimizes free energy or use this formula. So why go to all this trouble? Well, it turns out there are a lot of techniques for approximating free energy. And instead of writing it as a function of the big, humongous joint probability distribution, you can write it as a function of simpler things. If you write it as a function of the approximate marginal probabilities at each node, you get what's called mean field theory. So, let's see, what should I say? We have this functional, this free energy, the function of this thing, and we want to solve for this thing. And it's the one where if we vary all the, look over all possible joint probability distributions, it's the one that minimizes the free energy. But that's too hard to do. So instead, we'll restrict the form of the joint probability to being just probabilities at each node independent of all the others. And for a joint probability of that form, we'll see which one minimizes the free energy. And that will give us the mean field approximation to the marginal probabilities at every point. And then there's this so-called beta approximation. And Hans Bethe just died last week. And he was like 98 years old. So he did this in 1935. So he proposed writing the free energy as a function of the marginal probability at every point, or the belief at every point, and the energy, or the belief at pairs of points. And if you restrict your joint probabilities to something in this class, and find the ones that minimize the free energy, that gives you the beta approximation to the probabilities at every node and pair of nodes. And in our case, that gives you the belief propagation update rules. And then in the 1950s, researchers in Japan, led by Professor Kikuchi, continued on in this path, and they wrote the joint probability in a form that allowed even more complicated terms that were just singleton nodes, doubletons, and triplets, and other groups of nodes. And as you keep on this chain, eventually you'll get to functions of the whole thing. Once you have functions of the whole thing, if you find the probabilities to minimize that, that's going to be the exact right answer. But before you get there, these approximations are very useful. And so physicists use these so-called Kikuchi approximations. And then using this connection between the physics and the probability, we've developed new algorithms that are equivalent to using the Kikuchi approximations in the physics world. And they correspond to things that we call generalized belief propagation in the message passing world.
So let's just go and look at these variational methods.
So the mean field approximation to free energy, we're going to write this average energy minus T times the entropy, not as a function, not taking these expectations with respect to the most general possible probability distributions, and then minimizing over those to find the true joint probability. We'll instead write it over this restricted class of functions, where you define the joint probability, you just take these functions at each node and multiply them all together, ignoring the pairwise interactions for that part. And so then your free energy, variational free energy, has this form. It's the expected energy minus the entropy. And so then now you're confronted with the problem of finding the probabilities which minimize this function. So at this point, we all know what to do. We take derivatives of this thing with respect to those terms, set them equal to zero. And that gives you this result, which is also equation 18 in the paper that we're reading, which is that the mean field marginal probability
at every node is this form here. And it says in words, set the probability of each state at node I to be proportional to e to the minus expected energy corresponding to that state, taking into account the expected values of all the neighboring nodes. So that gives you an iterative update scheme, because you start out with some initial conditions on what these values are at every node, and just keep evaluating this equation over and over again, updating your belief in each of the states based on the belief in each of your neighbors on each of their states, and based on this interaction term between you and your neighboring state. So how good is mean field? It's often used. It's not as good as belief propagation, but it's a reasonable, it's much easier than belief propagation. It's a reasonable thing to try. So so then we can go on and write the free energy in this beta approximation instead of in the mean field approximation. Beta approximation, we take the expected energy, but we have to subtract out the time so we double count it, because this is based on the joint probability of neighboring nodes, and xj might be connected with a number of different nodes, and so we subtract out the number of times that that energy has been overcounted based on the marginal probability at node. The node that's connected to all the others.
So what was Q?
So Q is the overcounting. It's the number of neighbors that node I has. And this formula is exact when the lattice forms a tree or a chain, and it's only approximate if it doesn't. So we want to minimize the free energy. We have these other constraints, though. These things, these beliefs, have to be valid probabilities. So to really minimize them, we have to impose the constraints that when you integrate over all the states in the belief between two nodes, that it's going to add up to one. So we put in Lagrange multipliers, enforcing the constraint that summing over all the states at node at the belief at node I and j, the belief at node I and j has to be one. And we have another constraint, which is that these guys better be consistent with each other. But if you have the marginal probability between nodes I and node j, and you sum over all the states of node I, you better get the marginal probability at node j. And so that's another set of Lagrange multipliers on this constraint. So this term is sometimes called the Gibbs free energy. But now we do the same thing again. We differentiate with respect to these parameters that we want to find the value of, because we want to find the values for Vi and Vij that minimize this free energy subject to these constraints. And if you take the derivatives of that and set them equal to zero and solve, then you get these expressions for these marginal probabilities. So here's the marginal probability of node I, and it says calculate this function of the Lagrange multipliers multiplied by the local potential in node I, and that's proportional to your probability. And if you want to find the probability of a pair of nodes,
this says to multiply by this function of the local Lagrange multipliers and multiply by this your compatibility term between node I and node j. So the trick to seeing that this leads to belief propagation is to relate these Lagrange multipliers to messages. So if we right, if we make this identification between messages from node k to node j and Lagrange multiplier ij, and if you rewrite the expressions for the marginals we had on the previous slide in terms of these messages, you get this expression for the marginals at the node and the marginals at the pair of nodes. And it tells you to find the marginal probability of the node, you multiply all the incoming messages together and multiply by the local potential, and that gives you the marginal probability of that node. To find the joint probability at a pair of nodes, you multiply by all the messages coming into those two pairs and by the compatibility function here, and that gives you the marginal probability of those two states taken together. So what was the path for this? So we found this free energy, we put it in this restricted form, not the most general of all probabilities, but in terms of these local marginals. And we know that whatever, that the best we can do is to find the local marginals that minimize that free energy. So we took derivative set them equal to zero and solve, and we get these relations for what the local marginals ought to be. And these exactly give you the belief propagation update rules. Because when you go in to put in the constraints, you say that when we have a joint probability over a pair of nodes, and we marginalize out over the states of node J, we better get the marginal probability at a single node. That relationship has to hold. And so here it is written graphically, and if this has to equal this, then if you divide out by, all these three messages here are in common on both sides, and if you divide out by those, then we find that the message from node J to node I better equal the product of all the incoming messages in node J summed over, and then matrix multiplied by this compatibility between node I and node J. We get this formula. So that's an admittedly too quick sketch of how you go from the free energy formulation to the belief propagation update rule. But all those steps operate both ways, and so that you show that if the belief propagation has converged, in other words, if this relationship is true everywhere, then you found the states that minimize the free energy under the beta approximation. So that tells you what calculation you're making when you run belief propagation in a loopy network.
So this is only for undirected probes.
Yeah. And then there are ways to convert directed graphs into undirected graphs. So I think it's still generalized. So what is this? Sorry?
Question.
Yeah.
So when you in usually solve the Lagrange multiplier problem, you solve the Lagrange multiplier.
Sorry, wait.
When you do the Lagrange multiplier in other problems,
right,
you can solve the Lagrange multiplier. But in this case, you just set down equals to somewhere. So you look for the Lagrange
multiplier. So, so in some sense, this is solving for the Lagrange multipliers, but then we have to well, we want this relationship to hold. And so what we do is we keep iterating until we get, we don't have a closed form solution for the Lagrange multiplier, but we have this relationship between these beliefs. We have an equation that we just run iteratively until we get it satisfied. So eventually when we run belief propagation until convergence, we solve for the Lagrange multipliers, because the Lagrange multipliers are related to the messages by this formula. When it converges, right. Right. So that's a number of things. So one point about running it in the loopy networks, it doesn't always converge. Let's see, so what are the results from this free energy analysis? If you go through the step slowly enough, you find that you have a fixed point of belief propagation if and only if you have a stationary point of the beta approximation. And let's see, the free energy is bounded from below. So this shows that belief propagation always has a fixed point. And the other thing that was nice about this approach is that it draws the connection between belief propagation and these variational methods for inference. So there used to be these kind of two separate worlds, the people running belief propagation in networks with loops and people running variational approximations. And we didn't know how they're related to each other. But looking at it this way, you can see that they're both trying to minimize approximations to free energy. And the variational methods often work just in the primal variables alone, which are the local beliefs. And belief propagation is a set of fixed point equations for the dual variables, the Lagrange multipliers, or the messages. But they're both trying to minimize approximations to the free energy. And then another result of this approach was bringing the Kikuchi approximations, which are ways to solve for the free energy, making algorithms out of them by looking at using those to guide what the algorithms should be that have stationary points of the Kikuchi approximation as fixed points for the generalized belief propagation updates. And then another thing that this resulted in was a lot of people took this and sort of ran with it, saying, well, look, if what we're trying to do is minimize the beta approximation for free energy, let's not use these fixed point equations, let's just directly try to minimize it. And so that led to some new algorithms developed by Alan Newell and Maxwell and others that don't have these problems of not converging, but they just minimize the free energy, although they can be stuck in local minima. So this is just to show you a picture of what the Kikuchi message updates might be. So remember, the sort of procedure is we're going to describe the joint probability as a set of restricted functions. And for the mean field, we just did it, the probability as functions of the marginals of each node, independent of everything else. For the beta approximation, we looked at neighboring sets of nodes. For the Kikuchi approximation, you pick some cluster of local nodes and call that another cluster. And this generalizes the notion of a message. In addition to having vector messages coming around, you also, depending on what regions you choose, you can have matrix messages that describe the relationship and information not just about what this variable should be, but about how these two variables should relate to each other. And this is a graphical depiction. So you do the same thing. You draw the diagram for what the marginal probability of this pair of nodes is in terms of all the messages coming into it, and for what the marginal at a single node is in terms of all the messages coming into it. Cancel out messages that are on both sides, and you get this graphical description of how to pass a message under the Kikuchi approximation. You take all your individual messages, vector messages coming in, and also you multiply by these matrix messages that are coming into nodes I and J together, and sum over the states of node J, and you get the best vector message from node J to node I. And so to update the vector message,
you have this graphical relationship that the vector message, it's a matrix message, so node I and node j times these vector messages is equal to this configuration of the vector and matrix messages. And then you sum over the states of node k and l. So that's how you update this message based on these guys. So it's more complicated. You have to play with higher state dimensions. Instead of having messages that are vectors, you have messages that are arrays or higher dimensional structures. But you get much more accurate approximations. So here's one example. This is for a a 10 by 10 Markov random field. I won't draw all 100 of it, but so you have 100 nodes, and each one of them can have two possible states, and we can randomize the connectivity strength between each one of them. The way you can solve this exactly is treat each one of these rows as a 2 to the 10 dimensional state vector. And in that case, this thing then just looks like a chain. So then you can run the leaf propagation on this chain to get the exact answer for what the marginal probability of each node should be. And then you can compare it with the message passing approaches. So here's looking at the marginal probabilities of a single row. And let's see, the red is the true marginal probability for each of the 10 nodes in one row. That's what you want to find. The blue is the belief propagation result. Now, we had to run this lots of times to find ones where it got the wrong answer. And sometimes it got a really good answer. But in this case, it's way overconfident as to what this marginal probability should be using belief propagation. But then if you use generalized belief propagation and have every node of 4, every question of 4, be a cluster in the Kikuchi approximation and pass around those Kikuchi messages, you get the green line, which already is almost exactly right. So this leads to a suite of algorithms where you can trade off computation for accuracy, and if you really need to get a more accurate approximation, you can pay the price of a higher state dimensionality and more complicated messages and get better approximations. And why does it do such a good job just adding the next approximation in the series? Well, the things that are messing you up are sort of correlations between the messages. And the way you're going to get those correlations, they're going to be the worst in the really tight loops. So if you go in a loop and just have pass 4 messages, it's going to be very strongly related to the message that you sent out. And so that'll mess things up the most. Whereas the larger loops are going to be less of a problem. And so if you use these Kikuchi approximations and take care of these little tiny loops right away, they cause most of the damage in terms of belief propagation giving you a bad answer. So it often very quickly improves the accuracy of the approximation.
So for instance, the frustrated potentials, or did that attract potentials?
It was a spin graph that had frustrated potentials. And then I should mention that Wainwright has come up with methods, slight modifications to belief propagation, which give much better accuracy in networks with loops. And so you should definitely look into those. And I find it extremely difficult to understand Martin Wainwright's papers, I have to confess. But Yeager Weiss has recently shown that Wainwright's method is just a very simple continuation method. And so Yeager has a very simple explanation for these magical things that Martin Wainwright has been doing. So I would recommend reading Yeager's papers. Anyway, so Yeager Weiss recently has come up with a way that explains the nice behavior of Wainwright's method with a very much simpler explanation. But we're not going to talk about in this class. Here are some references where you can learn about belief propagation and generalized belief propagation.
So Pearl wrote this classic textbook on inference in Bayesian networks. I also find that to be not quite as clear as it should be, but it's certainly clear. What inspired me to apply belief propagation in vision problems was this 1998 NIPS paper by Yair Weiss, where he applied belief propagation to various problems. This is my work applying it to some of the examples that I'll show you later, I guess next class. People apply it to stereo. Wainwright is taking things further. And then Jonathan Yudidia, who's first author on a number of joint papers, he's a really clear writer. And so this is a really nice place to read about belief propagation and generalized belief propagation. While we're on the subject, I want to skip over the graph cuts slides and show you a vision application of using belief propagation in a network of loops. But this is a good place to ask your questions. Let me just go on. Suppose you were trying to estimate motion. So what does that mean? You look at pairs of images falling on your detector, and what you want to estimate is the underlying velocity of these things that are moving at every point. So this is kind of a pathological way to solve this problem, but it's something that we explored to look at using belief propagation. We trained up the whole thing. We made a little world of randomly shaped, randomly contrasted moving blobs, and just recorded lots of co-occurrence data of how often this pair of images co-occurred with this particular underlying velocity. So we quantized all the states. You have all possible images, and we discretize them into like 1 or 2,000 different possible states, all possible pairs of images that could fall on you with a local place. So this might have 2,000 dimensions here. This state is the underlying velocity that explains that motion, and that might be another 2,000 different states. And then we set up the connectivity compatibility functions in the Markov-Rennet field by measuring histograms of how often each of the different states occurred next to each other. And I'll, in the next class, we'll go over how you go from those histograms to actually estimating the compatibility matrices. But it's fairly straightforward to do, depending on how exact you want to be. But you can imagine that the frequency of occurrence of these two for all possible states would relate to what the compatibility is between those two. So we use that to measure the joint compatibility and set up the Markov-Rennet field. And then we just ran belief propagation to, given a set of observations landing on the image, to estimate what the underlying velocities were. So before you get started with this, you have to ask, what are the problems that a motion estimation algorithm is going to have to solve? Well, it has to solve the aperture problem. It has to solve the figure ground problem. You have to know whether it's the blob that's moving in the background is stationary or vice versa. And you have to resolve the aperture problem by propagating information across space.
So have I showed you this demo before?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, so you can't tell which way it's going, but if you have more information, you can see it. So let me just show you this demo program. So this was made by one of the smartest people I ever worked with. He's a really great programmer. Now he's working at Google. Anyway, these are examples from our visual world. And they're pairs of images. And you have the observation, which is here, at many different spatial scales, because we think that propagating across scales can be important. And you have the underlying velocity. So this is a labeled training set. So you take another random draw, and you have this image moving like this, and here's associated with it, here's the answer, the true velocities. So the standard problem with applying machine learning methods to computer vision is how are you going to represent things such that your state dimensionality doesn't explode? And so we took two things here. First of all, we didn't consider all possible images. We only considered this little restricted world of two-tone sets of blobs moving like this. And this was a restricted enough visual world that we could actually just vector quantize the whole thing. So here is our vector quantized description of the input image. In other words, we only allow some finite number of states to describe any of these, and this is the closest thing set of states to the real thing that was falling on our detector. So now we get to live in a discrete state world. Okay? And then we just measured the heck out of everything. We said, well, for every time that we saw this state here, how often each of the underlying true states occur? And we get these sets of data of these co-occurrence histograms for each of the resolution levels in the pyramid and for all of the possible states. Here's how often here's how often the true velocity in this node related to the true velocity in this neighboring node in the second level of the pyramid for bottom nodes related left to right. I think that's what that means. So we took all that data, and that was used in a way I'll explain next time to get the compatibility matrices in the Markov rank field. Then you run belief propagation. So for this image, we have the local evidence based on just looking at the local image information and what the probability for the true underlying data is. And then we also have the compatibilities that will influence belief propagation. So here's, if I show, this is our vocabulary also, So here's pieces of image information, and here's underlying velocity. And if you click on one of these, then the underlying velocities organize themselves according to what's the most likely explanation for this thing here. So here's a patch of image information. Let's take this one first. So here we're looking at this guy there, and here's frame 0, frame 1. These guys, since I clicked on him, they've organized themselves in decreasing order of probability of explaining that local patch based on the local evidence alone. So this is way overwhelmingly most likely to be a blank patch. But there's some chance, sometime, 4,874 times, we saw a uniform motion up associated with this pair of image patches. And also sometimes we saw a uniform motion to the right, left, down, so forth. And if we click on, say, this... Oh wait, what's a good one? This image. Okay, so here's another piece of local data, and here are the possible explanations for it.
Where's the second image? That's the first image? Where's it?
So here's, now I'm flipping everybody. We're just actually focusing on this guy here, and these guys are all ordered in frequency of explaining that one.
So the rest of those images on the left don't.
Yeah, right. So that's correct. So right now we're just looking at this one, and all these guys are. This is the most probable for explaining this one and so forth.
Yeah. So I can answer that question. I mean, there's what the image looks like.
Yeah.
But that's I mean, the same image patch can occur for the same object having gone this way in one trial and this way in another trial.
Right, and so that's all kept. So most of 2,110 times, this thing explained that, but 1,340 times, this thing explained that, and this thing also explained that, and this thing also explained that.
So if I show you the same object but with novel movement, this method would fail.
No, there's both. It's both. So this guy is just looking at a local patch, so it sees a pair of image intensities, and it tries to explain them by the underlying labeled velocities. So this has folded into it different objects moving different ways. And sometimes the different objects give the same appearance, so does that make sense?
Yeah. So are there two patches or just one patch?
There's two patches of image information. There's also two patches, frame one, frame two.
So that's one is frame one, and another is frame two?
So we vector quantize the pair of frame one and frame two into a vector. So, you know, I should let you guys go, but let me just run it, okay? And then I can pick it up next time. So here's, after no iterations of belief propagation, just looking at the local evidence alone, here's what we think the explanation is. We don't know what's going on except at the edges, and there we suffer from the aperture problem. Here in the interior of the thing, we don't see any motion. But now let's add an iteration of belief propagation. And now things start to fill in. Now why is it fill in? Because it sees things from other spatial scales, and they start talking to each other. Let's see. Oh yeah, and I can press on one of these and see, this is just showing the most likely explanation for this, but underlying each one of these is a set of probabilities in all the different possible states. And as we run belief propagation, the probabilities change for each, change their relative likelihood. So this guy has this set of probabilities now, and we click on it next iteration, and it's changed its distribution of probabilities. Let's add six iterations, because by then it usually gets solved. And so after 6 iterations of belief propagation, it's got a reasonably good description of the motion that was going on. Let's see, I have the original one there. So here's the vector quantized representation of the true motion, and here's what belief propagation comes up with, and it's not exactly the same, but it's a pretty good guess. So we'll revisit this after spring break, and good luck in finishing up the exam, and have a great spring break, and see you a week from Tuesday.
Thank you.